And you're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, Washington. KPTZ now joins the board, County Board of Commissioner, a weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health date held as a virtual meeting during the pandemic. And Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Allison Berry and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners. So here's Willie in progress.
Some of the work we did last week in the disaster preparedness field, last week was Cascadia Rising, a large statewide tabletop exercise to prepare for a large Cascadia catastrophic earthquake that focused on critical transportation routes, as well as like mass care and sheltering, how we take care of folks afterwards. And we also had an exercise on Saturday utilizing DART, the Disaster Air Response Team, a group of private volunteer pilots, flew in food from airports like Port Angeles, Bellingham, Renton, Walla Walla, with about a dozen coming into Jefferson County. And then it was an exercise where we used our amateur radio, our VCOM operators to communicate the private volunteer pilot to bring donated food in. And then we ended up donating about 3,400 pounds of food that was flown in using these private volunteer pilots to the Jefferson County Food Bank Association. This to simulate a post-disaster scenario where our regular modes of transportation are unavailable to us, and these private volunteer pilots ostensibly being our only lifeline to the outside world. So a lot of good practice for us last week, starting to prepare for the next major disaster. Most of what we learned, we actually already knew that we are pretty severely underprepared for a major Cascadia earthquake, that we do really need folks at an individual level to take charge of their own preparedness, talk to your families, talk to your neighbors, start building up your disaster kit, because Cascadia earthquake is going to be catastrophic. It's going to be potentially the worst disaster in U.S. history. It's going to hit us pretty hard here. So some good lessons learned for us last week, but another call to action for our citizens to take their own personal preparedness seriously. Last thing I wanted to say is we are going to start seeing some warm weather this weekend. Nothing like we saw in the heat dome last June, but we should start creeping up into the 70s. I wanted to call folks' attention to the National Weather Service has a heat risk index that I'd encourage folks to look at. It's what we'll be using as one of the trigger points for when we start to look at severe weather shelters like cooling centers. Unfortunately, this weekend's weather is just in the yellow category, which means a slightly elevated risk, nothing too severe. But I know that's been a question that's come up to the commissioners and to me through these briefings a number of times. So we should start seeing some warming this weekend. Thankfully, nothing too severe. But for folks who are concerned about that, definitely check out the heat risk map on the National Weather Service website. Other than that, barring any questions, that's the end of my report.
Willie, I'm just curious. I mean, you said 3,400 pounds of food by the volunteer pilots. How much food would we need to, in Jefferson County with a population of over 30,000, how much food would we need for a week? Have you figured that out?
Not in terms of, I don't have that off the top of my head. We did have one of our staff a while back have those calculations, so I can dig those up and report back on that. But needless to say, it's quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And so these single engine aircraft that we can get in, and part of the benefits of that post-disaster is obviously they can land at our airport, but in a pinch, there are stretches of highway, there are open fields that they would potentially be able to land and to deliver food into cut off communities. But they can carry anywhere from 250 to 500 pounds each. But that equals a lot of trips out and back in, never mind in a post-disaster scenario where fuel is going to be extremely limited. So this is a really valuable lifeline for us, but it's not the end-all be-all answer. We have worked on other things like working with the Navy to survey beachheads that they would be able to use to land on to deliver critical supplies in. But they are going to be 3 weeks to a month before they actually come in to service Jefferson County, just given that they're going to go to the larger population areas first. So we have a few resources that we are working on, but again, they're going to be a long way out. It's going to take a lot of work to get them in. So we really look for folks to take personal responsibility, build your own emergency kit, talk to your neighbors.
I see Kate has her hand up. Kate, you're muted. Commissioner,
can you hear me now?
Yep, we can hear you now.
Great, thank you. Willie, I just want to say I've been spending some time looking at resources on your website. I recently bought a van, a very funky converted passenger van, and be a camper van. And it's been a great opportunity to think about camping supplies as emergency preparedness supplies. And I've gotten much more organized, and through looking at some of the resources linked on your website, have discovered that things like rechargeable power banks have gotten way cheaper with solar panels. And so I just appreciate the work that you're doing, and want to put in a plug for folks to get organized. And, you know, just a few bins of camping gear can quickly become an emergency preparedness kit too. And the technology's gotten better and the prices have gotten lower.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal point, and also really great news. I'm glad to hear you're doing some work, and that's a great way to think about disaster preparedness. It's just camping in a very basic sense, that you lack modern amenities. Like after an earthquake, you might lack running water in your home. You're not going to be able to run to the grocery store. You may have to shelter in place. And so it's going to be more or less just like camping, you know, cooking on a small propane stove, eating those, you know, backpacker type foods that, you know, you used to add hot water to, but have a long shelf life, et cetera. So I'm a little bit less of an intimidating way to think about preparing for a catastrophic emergency. It's just another form of camping. So I'm glad to hear you're doing that work. And again, good plug for that kind of paradigm, that way of thinking.
Thanks for the update, Willie. We really appreciate all the work you and your team do. Good morning, Dr. Berry. And we have until 10:30.
Okay.
We have a hearing at 10:30. So the floor is yours, my dear.
All right. Well, I will do my best to be efficient. Update on the COVID front. So nationally, we are seeing that cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are largely plateauing. Still at very high rates of cases, but our deaths are on the lower end than they have been, but we're still losing a little over 300 Americans every day due to COVID-19. In Washington state, we're seeing a very similar trend. Cases and hospitalizations and deaths are also largely plateauing. In Jefferson County, we have largely seen a plateau, but we have seen what we think will be a relatively limited bump this week in case rates, due primarily to end of school year gatherings. There were a lot of private gatherings related to the end of the school year, and we saw some outbreaks related to that. So our total number of cases is 4,567. Our case rate is 979, so quite high right now, though we do think that will come back down with a 14% positivity. We have one person currently hospitalized for COVID-19 for a total of 133 hospitalizations and 30 deaths due to this virus. So no new deaths today. The person in the hospital is doing quite well and is on track to discharge today. In Clallam County, I haven't received the numbers yet this morning, but as of Friday, our case rate for Clallam was 657, and we had one person in the hospital as well. So overall, we are continuing to see this trend where our case rates are very, very high, but we're not seeing a spike in severe disease here, which is very hopeful. And as we've discussed on this call before, really, I think does signal a transition in phase in our response to this virus. So we are moving to a more management stage where we really, in our department, primarily focus a lot of our work on managing transmission in high-risk settings. So we're still working a lot on outbreak control in long-term care facilities, jails, prisons, working closely with the schools, but we don't do as much outbreak control in the general community when you see this high rate of transmission. Along with that transition in phase, this next week, we're going to be transitioning our data reporting as well. So starting next week, we're going to be moving away from a daily case rate update or a daily case update to a weekly one. So if you go to our website, and there is certainly a big group of our community who watch every day for those numbers updates, we are going to be transitioning to a weekly update going forward. The main reasons for that are that it really takes a lot of staff time to make that daily number update. It really takes a lot of the time of our nursing staff. And we do think that at this point in the response, a weekly update will be enough to inform the public to make decisions around their safety. And we're hoping to pull our nurses into some additional work, some of the work that we've had to shelve during the COVID-19 pandemic, other important public health work, including pulling them into some pediatric vaccination. And so to speak to that, one very good piece of news, especially as a parent of a very small child, is that this last week, the pediatric COVID-19 vaccine for kids 6 months to 5 years was approved. And those vaccines are just starting to be shipped to our community now. The first doses are arriving this week in the Jefferson County. So a little bit about the pediatric vaccine. So this is the vaccine approved for kids 6 months to 5 years, which is the only group of kids in our community that have not yet had the opportunity to get vaccinated. Looking at the FDA discussion of the data around these vaccines, there are two approved formulations. One is the Moderna formulation, which is a two-dose series. One is the Pfizer formulation that is a three-dose series. A common question I get from parents who are watching this closely is, which one should I get? I would say whichever one your pediatrician's office has, or your family doctor or the public health department has, it's whichever one you can get. Some parents might be interested in going for the Moderna because it's a two-dose series. I would caution that I think it is very likely to become a three-dose series in time, just like the other vaccines have. So I wouldn't hang your hat on the two versus three doses, because we could very well see a booster required for the Moderna series. So they're likely to both be three-dose series in the end. A little bit about the data on these. So what they saw in the trials for both of these vaccines is that children in this age group had neutralizing antibody levels equivalent to those seen in older populations. And this is pretty standard for how we study efficacy of vaccines in children. It's something called immunobridging. So because, thankfully, severe outcomes are relatively rare in small children and these trials tend to be smaller, we look a lot at their antibody levels. And if we see equivalent antibody levels to those seen in older populations, we determine that they are likely to be as efficacious in preventing severe disease in those populations. We also saw in the real world outcomes that they were efficacious in preventing severe disease. So we are very hopeful that these will go a long way to reduce severe disease in small children. Many parents likely have some questions about whether or not they need to vaccinate their kids who are under five. I think the public discussion around COVID-19 and children has often focused on the fact that severe outcomes are less common in this population than in our older populations, and that is true. But unfortunately, severe outcomes are still much more common than we would like to see. Over 400 children in this age group under five have died due to COVID-19. And the majority of those were actually in the last year. So it wasn't in 2020. It was really, we saw a significant spike in pediatric hospitalization and death in the Omicron wave. And the primary age group that drove that spike was kids under five, who didn't have access to the vaccine yet. So it is this virus, well, thankfully, it is less commonly severe in this age group. It still can be quite severe. And we don't want that to happen, especially when we have an available, safe, and effective vaccine to prevent that. One data point that I think commonly gets talked about. So we talk about how many kids have died due to COVID-19 in this age group. And unfortunately, I hear conversation that, well, 400 doesn't sound like that many. And I would say, to me, 400 children dead is a lot. I think if we can prevent the deaths of 400 kids, that's very much worthwhile. I think it's also important to know that, thankfully, children do not often die in this age range. And so COVID-19 in 2021 was the fifth leading cause of death in children 0 to 5. And so it's a big driver of mortality right now. And that's something we now have a vaccine that we can prevent. So I would strongly recommend that families move forward with getting their kids vaccinated in this age group. I can tell you that I certainly plan on getting my daughter vaccinated as soon as possible. For those who are interested in getting vaccinated, I want to acknowledge that many of us have been waiting for this for a long time. And so you might, many of us really want to get this done right now. I would say the vaccines are just starting to come into our community. How to access the vaccine? So there's two primary places where you can get your kiddo vaccinated if they're under 5. One is at Jefferson Healthcare and one is at Jefferson County Public Health. So you can check on either of our websites or you can call the COVID hotline to go ahead and get your kiddo scheduled. I would say we are likely to see vaccination starting at Jefferson Healthcare next week, probably not this week. So hang tight just a little bit. Starting next week, we should be able to get your kiddo vaccinated. And at Jefferson Public Health, we should be starting either next week or potentially the week after, but we'll get some more updates on the website shortly. The biggest challenge in vaccinating this age population is that it does require specialized skill. Many of our volunteers who vaccinated before only work with adults. Vaccinating infants is a special skill that not everybody has. And so, especially as our healthcare system continues to be strained under the weight of the last couple of years, finding staff to vaccinate very small children is the biggest limitation right now. But we will be vaccinating at Jefferson Public Health, and we'll be putting out a press release later this week for how to access that. We'll also likely see something similar out of Jefferson Healthcare. But those are your two sites to vaccinate. I'd say hang tight this week. Starting next week, give us a call and we'll help get you on the schedule. One of our questioners asked a little bit, was focused on vaccines, and particularly about evaluating the risks and benefits of vaccines in this population. So we dug into a little bit about the risks due to COVID-19, and I think parents, understandably, especially given some of the coverage, are often a little nervous about the possible risks of the vaccine. So I wanted to go over a little bit of what we've seen so far in the trials related to this age range. So the most common side effect in kids who got this vaccine in the trials was pain in their arm. The next most common side effect after that was a fever. Fevers after vaccinations, especially in small children, are pretty common. And they're generally very well treated by pediatric Tylenol or pediatric ibuprofen, depending on the age of the child. But generally, pediatric acetaminophen or Tylenol is going to be your best treatment available. So as a mom whose daughter gets vaccines, I make sure that I have some Tylenol around in case she gets a fever afterwards and she needs to be treated. Not all fevers need to be treated, but a fever over 104 does. And many kids feel more comfortable if their fever comes down. So if your kid's uncomfortable, they have a fever, taking a little Tylenol, getting them well hydrated is usually all you need to do. And that's really what we saw predominantly in these trials. Very small children, in very rare instances, regardless of the cause, when they get a fever, sometimes can actually get a seizure. It's called a febrile seizure. It can be caused by viruses, but it can also be caused by fevers that come from vaccine. That was seen a couple of times in the trials. That is something that happens sometimes in small children when they get a virus or when they get a high fever due to a vaccine. The best treatment for that is if your kiddo has a high fever over 104, is to go ahead and treat them with Tylenol. Certainly, if you ever saw a seizure in a small child, you should contact your medical provider for assistance. But we have not seen actually that the vaccine caused that. It's just something that can rarely happen in small children when they get a fever. And we see it sometimes in kids who have colds as well. So weighing the risks and benefits of these vaccines, one of the things that we are watching for is myocarditis. That is something that we saw in vaccines for older children. That is not something that we saw in any of the trials for the children under 5. That is thankfully a very rare outcome that showed up in some of the vaccines for older kids. And so we would not necessarily have seen it in the trials at this point. But looking at the children of the next age group up, so kids 5 to 11, we've given over 19 million doses of the vaccine in this country for kids 5 to 11. And there were 20 cases of myocarditis in that age group. The vast majority of those were very mild and resolved on their own. There have been no deaths due to the vaccine in that age group. Compare that to the number of children that we lost due to COVID-19 or who had severe myocarditis due to their COVID-19. The risk-benefit ratio is very, very clear. Getting the vaccine is much, much safer than getting COVID-19 in this age group. The other common question that I often get from parents is, well, my kid had COVID-19 already in the last couple of years because there wasn't a vaccine available. As we discussed on this call, mine is in that category. So parents often ask, should they get vaccinated if their kid already had COVID? And the answer is yes. So with Omicron and with the variants that we're seeing right now, we're not seeing very good protection against severe disease from just prior infection without vaccination. So vaccination remains critical for preventing those most severe outcomes in small children, even if they had COVID. So even though my daughter relatively recently recovered from her COVID, we're going to get her vaccinated because I don't want her to have severe disease due to COVID. I don't want her to get hospitalized. I don't want her to die. The other things that we're working hard to prevent are two other pretty negative outcomes related to COVID, actually three. So one is myocarditis. Myocarditis is dramatically more common due to COVID infection than it is to the vaccine. And the myocarditis that comes from COVID is much more severe than the rare outcome we sometimes see with the vaccine. We tend to see permanent disability when people get myocarditis from COVID versus those who get myocarditis from the vaccine tend to recover entirely on their own and go back to a totally normal life. The other thing we're working to prevent is multi-system inflammatory disease. So that's a rare outcome we've seen in small children from COVID, where they get this diffuse inflammatory response throughout their body. They get a terrible rash and failure of multiple organs. That's a rare outcome from COVID, and we've seen that the risk of it is dramatically reduced in those who have been vaccinated. So we're really hopeful that we can prevent that outcome with getting vaccinated. And the other big thing that we want to prevent is long COVID. Unfortunately, we do see long COVID in small children who are recovering from their COVID infections. We see persistent cough, persistent shortness of breath, brain fog, trouble concentrating, and actually persistent depression after COVID-19 infection. And so getting vaccinated has shown efficacy at reducing the risk of long COVID as well. So those are all the reasons that come together for why it's a really good idea to get your young child vaccinated and why we plan to do so in my family as well. And so with that, I'm happy to take any questions from the commissioners.
I have to unmute. Greg or Kate, do you have any questions for Dr. Berry this morning?
No, great digging in for the exciting new opportunities for, you know, vaccinations for young kids. So thanks for breaking it down so logically.
Thank you.
Kate, do you have any questions? I see you're unmuted.
Believe it or not, I don't.
All right. Great. I had one question about, I'm getting a lot of questions about the, you know, that we're still in this high risk category, but if people are feeling like we're in a different phase with COVID, when are we going to talk about kind of adjusting our sidebars, if you will, for this more kind of normal or in, as you have called it, endemic phase of the pandemic?
So you mean like kind of adjusting the risk dial?
Yeah. I mean, is there an idea of doing that or other communities doing that?
It's certainly something we're talking about, you know, what is the appropriate rate of, for instance, even just monitor cases in this next phase. And I do think there will come a time, really probably in the next couple of months, where we'll transition to a different kind of surveillance when it comes to COVID-19 cases. Right now, we still try to count them all the best we can. And we will likely transition away from that in the coming months to looking at what's called sentinel surveillance, where we're looking at a certain pocket of labs throughout the state and in the county that we monitor, as opposed to trying to count all cases. And so I think that is probably the time where we'll transition away from transition the risk dial into responding to the sentinel surveillance system. I would say, as an individual, if you are vaccinated, boosted, and you have a functioning immune system, COVID-19 is unlikely to lead to severe outcomes for you. And so it's reasonable to start practicing safety differently if you're in that group. If you're unvaccinated, unfortunately, COVID-19 can still be quite severe. And if you are vaccinated, but you have immunosuppression, if you're a cancer patient, it can still be quite severe. And so when we have this much transmission in the community, certainly if you're in any of those high risk groups, I strongly recommend wearing a high quality mask when you're out and about. And I still wear a mask in indoor settings, even though I'm vaccinated and boosted, so that I can protect them. Those high-risk folks, those vulnerable folks in our community. And I think that's still a good idea right now. I don't know that we'll always be at this high a rate of transmission. I do think it will come down. But I also think in the coming months, we'll transition to surveillance differently. And we'll talk some more about changing the risk style when that happens.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Berry. I think I've left you a total of 5 minutes for KPTZ questions that you haven't already addressed.
I think we can do it. We don't have too many. Okay. So one was talking about kind of accessibility of health officers in the pandemic, and kind of all of us have handled it differently of how we've tried to be accessible to the public. I do want to acknowledge that many of us have, depending on the county and depending on how well-funded their public health system is, have very different number of hours that they have a health officer. So some of our counties actually only have a health officer for like 5 hours a week. And so they're not able to accomplish the same things. And I want to acknowledge that throughout the pandemic, I have not been able to respond to every individual email I get. Unfortunately, we get so many. But I think things like this program are very helpful as a place where people can raise questions and we can answer them for the benefit of the whole public. Often when I get lots of emails, they're all about the same thing. And so I really want to thank KPTZ for giving us this forum where we can answer those questions in a broad way that reaches the public as a whole. So I really appreciate this forum and the commissioners for giving us this forum as well.
And you, Dr. Berry, I mean, you've been so consistent and such a resource for the community. You can thank us, but we really need to thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I want to thank the folks who keep sending us questions because it's really helpful. It affects how we manage our communications and also can affect programs. So I've definitely gotten more than one question that has helped shape the way that we deliver services. So keep them coming. It's really helpful. Another one is about this person says, we've heard that once you get COVID, it's very unusual to get it again for 90 days. Is that correct? And how do we know that that's the case? And it is correct. You are unlikely to get COVID again within 90 days after a prior infection. It's not impossible. We have seen reinfections as short as 30 days after a prior infection. That was most common from Delta to Omicron, but we do still occasionally see it now. It's much less common. The way that we know that is we actually do monitor our cases. So we keep track of who they are. And if they get symptoms again and test again, then we find out about reinfections and we link them back up in our system. If it's within 90 days and you have new symptoms, if it's within 30 days, you really don't need to retest. If it's within 90 days in that 30 to 90 day window and you have new illness symptoms, we do recommend you test, but with an antigen test. The PCR tests will continue to be positive from your prior infection. You won't be able to distinguish, but an antigen test will become negative and then positive again. So if more than 30 days have elapsed and you've got new symptoms and you're positive on an antigen test again, you're probably infected again, though that's uncommon. So generally that 90-day window is pretty solid. After 90 days, we see a dramatic spike in reinfections. And so just a prior infection alone is not enough to protect you after 90 days, which is why it's so important to move forward with getting vaccinated if you haven't already. This next person asks about exactly that, about a prolonged PCR positivity. You can test positive for months. The longest I've seen in our jurisdiction was 4 months after a prior infection. So we don't recommend continued PCR testing. Antigen tests can also continue to test positive, but for a shorter period of time, up to about 2 weeks. And so after day 10, you don't have to keep testing. If you generally will end your isolation if it's 10 days after your symptom onset, and if you're fever-free and your symptoms are improving, you can go ahead and leave isolation. If you have any persistent symptoms and you're at all concerned, wearing a mask when you're around others in indoor settings should be enough to prevent any ongoing transmission. And let me just double check. One last quick question and then we'll get you to your hearing. So this person said that vaccinated people are less likely to be contagious when they don't have symptoms. And that's true. We talked about that last time. This person's asked whether or not that's also true about people who have had a prior infection. And I would say yes in that 90-day window, but not as clear beyond that 90-day window. So if people were infected well over a year ago, we see their antibody levels drop and they can still be pre-symptomatically shedding. So it's really primarily vaccinated folks that we're not seeing that pre-symptomatic transmission. And now I think it's 10:30 and time for your hearing. So thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. Thank you, Willie, for being with us this morning. We're all gonna go. There's gonna be a run on camping meals in the community. Watch out for those buckets at Costco. They're gonna fly off the shelves.
Okay. Thank you all.
Thanks, you guys.